Israel is pushing ahead with its deadly airstrikes on the Gaza Strip amid growing concerns about the humanitarian catastrophe in the enclave. Hamas has rejected Western claims that it violated human rights during its Saturday operation against Israel. The group says it only targeted military forces. And more pro-Palestinian solidarity marches have been held around the world as Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip continue to claim innocent lives. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Israeli warplanes have targeted yet another residential building in northern Gaza as the regime's deadly onslaught on the besieged Palestinian territory enters its sixth day. At least 44 people were killed and dozens injured in the strike on the building in the city of Jabalia. Meanwhile, emergency workers in Gaza pulled the bodies of 18 people from the rubble of two shattered homes in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry says the death toll has risen to over 1,400, with more than 6,200 wounded since Israel began pounding Gaza on Saturday. It says most of the casualties are women and children. According to the UN, some 340,000 Gazans have been displaced. Brazil, which currently holds the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council, called a meeting of the body on Friday to discuss the ongoing Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The International Committee of the Red Cross has warned that hospitals in Gaza are turning into graveyards after equipment stopped working due to a lack of power supply. The humanitarian organization says power cuts have put at risk the lives of newborns in incubators, elderly patients on oxygen, patients on dialysis, and others. The ICRC says all 13 hospitals in Gaza are only partially operational because of severe shortages of fuel and crucial medical supplies. Hospitals across Gaza are reeling from a shortage of staff and supply, while the number of critically injured is growing due to indiscriminate Israeli bombardment. On Wednesday, Gaza's sole power plant ran out of fuel and shut down after Israel's decision to cut off supplies. Three of the five water plants in Gaza are also out of service. The Israeli bombardment has leveled 1,000 homes since Saturday, and many in Gaza face dire shortages of water, fuel, and medical supplies. Palestinian resistance groups launch more rockets toward the occupied territories as the Israeli death toll rises to 1,300. The Hamas resistance movement says the rockets were fired toward Tel Aviv in response to the killing of civilians in Gaza. According to Israeli media, multiple rockets fell in northern Israel, including Netanya and Hadera. Southern Israeli towns of Ashkelon and Ashdod have also been targeted. Sirens also sounded in the city of Sderot. The retaliatory operations come as Israel has been massing its troops and tanks near the Gaza fence and are getting ready for a ground invasion. Israel has used international banned white phosphorus bombs in its strikes in Gaza's Karamah neighborhood. Over 2 million Palestinians are trapped in the Gaza Strip, which is known as the world's biggest open-air prison. Hamas has dismissed Western criticism that it violated human rights in the Saturday operation that caught Israel flat-footed. The resistance group says the sole targets were Israeli military forces. Saleh al-Aruri, deputy head of the Hamas political bureau, said the Al-Qassam Brigade's attack was an organized operation that targeted the Israeli military's Gaza division. He said hundreds of resistance forces managed to dismantle that division within just 3 hours. He said Hamas did not target unarmed Israelis, but Palestinian civilians who used the opportunity to enter the Israeli-occupied territories clashed with settlers and killed a number of them. Haruri said Hamas does not see an outcome for the ongoing battle except victory. The Hamas official said the West accuses Palestinians of committing crimes against humanity, but it ignores Israel's appalling record of targeting civilians. Investigative journalist Asa Winstanley from London comments on how the Western media distorts the truth about the crimes of Israel against the Palestinians.
Well, the context I'm working in is the West. The Western media we're seeing at the moment is particularly untrustworthy on the issue of Palestine, especially. The Western media has been putting out all kinds of atrocity propaganda, essentially, from Israel, and, you know, unverifiable and highly dubious and often anonymous Israeli sources. And we're seeing, and these disinformation stories are a way for the Palestinian resistance to be delegitimized in the West. And so the context of the British media and the Western media in general when it covers the issue of Palestine is always missing the actual reality on the ground and the real history and the immediate history. And even the last year, for example, is always missing. So, for example, it's never mentioned or very rarely mentioned in the Western media that even before the start of Al-Aqsa flood operation on Saturday, around 250 Palestinians had been killed this year, a record number of killings by the Israeli occupation forces in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And so we can see that, you know, the idea that this operation by the resistance forces came out of nowhere is a really misleading one. And even deeper than that, the actual fundamental cause of violence in Palestine is missing the fact that Palestinians were driven out of their homeland by force, by violence, by massacres, even by rapes in some instances by Israeli and Zionist forces.
More pro-Palestinian solidarity marches have been held around the world as Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip continue to claim innocent lives. Thousands of protesters hit the streets of Jordan's capital, Amman, demanding the government to end its relations with Israel and to expel the regime's ambassador. In Chicago, protesters condemned Israeli aggression against the Palestinians and chanted anti-Israeli slogans. The outpouring of anger against the occupying regime also fueled rallies in South Africa cities. A large number of people protested outside of the U.S. consulate in Johannesburg, criticizing Israel for what they called oppression of Palestinians. Also in Cape Town, people expressed outrage at Israeli bombings of Gaza, calling for the liberation of Palestine. Israel is expanding its campaign of airstrikes, this time targeting Syria. It has attacked two Syrian airports, putting them out of service. Israeli airstrikes hit Damascus and Aleppo airports. Syrian media say that air defenses were activated to confront the strikes. No casualties have been reported in Aleppo, and in Damascus, there has been no information on the impact of the strikes. In recent years, Israel has conducted hundreds of airstrikes on the Syrian territory, targeting the army positions and other areas. Israel's recent airstrikes come in the wake of the regime's incessant bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip. The strikes have led to the grounding of flights at the two airports. Israel rarely comments on strikes it carries out on Syria. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian is in Baghdad amid current developments in the region. The minister was welcomed by Iraq's National Security Advisor Qasem al-Arji. Earlier we were joined by our correspondent Mahdi Abbasian for more.
Today, at 2 p.m. Local Tehran time, Mr. Amir Abdollahian left Mehrabian Airport in Tehran for Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, to hold meetings, bilateral talks with senior officials of the country, and also discuss the latest regional developments, particularly what's going on in the Palestinian territories, especially the Gaza Strip. Upon arrival, he was welcomed at the airport by the National Security Advisor of Iraq, Mr. Qasem al-Arji. Then he went to the building of National Security Advisory of Iraq in Baghdad, where he held a more, let's say, thorough discussion with Mr. al-Arji there. And their meeting just finished minutes ago.
Let's get some analysis into the picture here. Saad Nimr is a professor of political science joining us from Birzeit University, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Welcome. Saad Nimr, we're looking at the mere fact that you have an operation that's being executed by Israel, of which it is nothing short than a massacre that's taking place in front of the eyes of the international community, where perhaps like no other time in the history, you have an entity by the name of Israel that comes out and says, I'm going to commit war crimes. I'm going to cut off food, electricity, gas to the besieged people there in the Gaza Strip, with the aim of that would be to starve them, which ultimately would lead to their deaths. And yet you have, like the U.S. Stating we're out there to support you. How does that make you feel, knowing that Palestinians are getting massacred that way in the form and manner that it's happening?
The situation is really, sad about the international community. Israel today declared officially the war, and Netanyahu and the Knesset declared the war. And it hasn't happened since 1973. All the wars that Israel after 73 they did, it was only, they call it operations. But now they call it a war, and that to get the legitimization of using an excessive force against the Palestinians. What is going on today in Gaza, it's not a war, it's a war crimes only, not war, it's war crimes, what the Israeli are doing. Now, the support by the United States is absolutely, we do know that the United States is supporting Israel all the time, and they even exceeded this time by giving them a kind of a green line to go ahead. Not only that, but also willing to shut up anyone in Europe or anywhere else who dare to criticize Israel in this respect. So they give them, an open hand in doing whatever they want to do. And hence the Israeli statement saying that we are dealing with animals and we are going to cut the electricity, the water, and the food and the medicine, and that's exactly what Gaza today is suffering from, lack of all these. Today, the electricity is finished, that's it, no more electricity now in Gaza, because whatever left of fuel yesterday, it's just finished, and now we are concerned about hospitals who have not only no electricity and no water, and also no medical supplies, which they urgently need. And also the citizens of Gaza, whoever left in Gaza, they are also asking for water to drink. There is no drinking water even. So the situation is really, really very, very bad. Now, what about the international community regarding this? They are, supporting Israel, and the claim usually that the United States is using that Israel have the right to defend itself. Okay. Now, please, someone just explain to us as Palestinians, how could the occupier have the right to defend itself? They are occupation. They are the one who is doing the atrocities from the very beginning. They are the one who attacked us in Palestine. And they now have the right to defend themselves. The occupier have the right. If someone attack you at home, and you can't do anything about him, and he have the right to defend himself, and you don't have that right. So this is absolutely something we can't, even tolerate anymore with this hypocritic international community. Today, what we are trying to do is to be in contact with all grassroots organizations and grassroots movements around the world, our friends and those who could understand or understand the Palestinian question, to stand by and to go into demonstrations, try to pressurize their own government to make some changes. Now, after almost a week of the Israeli bombardments to Gaza, we started to hear few voices, very, very, if you like, shy voices from Europeans saying, well, yeah, you can't cut the electricity and the water. There are some, humanistic aspects that you have to monitor. But the Israeli, they don't care, and they are going to go ahead in this unless there is really a stand by the international community to say, stop. This is, you can't go ahead with that any longer, because what you are doing is not a war. And let's ask this question. Israel usually say that we have targets. Were there targets? They are not targeting anyone of the resistance. They are targeting only the civilians. They are bombarding the homes and the buildings and bring it down on the heads of the people who are living there without any regret and without any even blemish. They don't care. even if more and more Palestinians, and this is the aim from their point of view, they wanted to reach a high number of casualties among the Palestinians just to justify their failure in front of their own people and to say, see, now we retaliated. You know, just justify their failure in security, failure, their army failure, and all the response failure in Israel after the operation on Saturday. So they will put it now against the Palestinian citizens and the civilians in this way to just to get justification and to get a kind of satisfaction for this government that they are doing something about what's going on after Saturday.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The unprecedented military operation by the Palestinian resistance movement against the apartheid Israeli regime has shaken and exposed the fragility of the Zionist regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "What can motorized paragliders do in the face of one of the most formidable militaries in the world? Apparently much in the hands of an innovative Palestinian resistance, which early on Saturday, October 7th, launched a surprise attack on the occupied territories by air, land and sea. Indeed, as stunning videos show, these paragliders have become the air force of the Palestinian resistance. Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, the major offensive led by Hamas on October 7th, was not expected by anyone. It came in retaliation for the ongoing Israeli regime programs in the West Bank town of Hawara and Al-Quds, especially by settlers storming Al-Aqsa Mosque during the Jewish High Holy Days over the last month, not to mention the ongoing siege against Gaza itself for more than a decade and a half. The consensus of many Arab media commentators is that the resistance has effectively obliterated the myth of Israeli regime military might and the undeserved reputation of its intelligence apparatus, whose failures, judging from the shocking success of the Palestinian offensive, are staggering." No less astonishing was the Palestinian resistance takeover of several Israeli settler colonies near the Gaza boundary and even as far away as 22 kilometers as in the case of Ofakim. Perhaps the major achievement of the resistance in the temporary takeover of these settler colonies is the death blow to any confidence that Zionist colonists had in their military and its ability to protect them. reports promptly emerged that thousands of Israelis were fleeing through the desert on foot to escape the rockets and gunfire, with many still hiding inside the settlements more than 24 hours into the resistance offensive. Those who had not already fled were being evacuated by the army from more than 2 dozen colonies near Gaza. In the interest of safeguarding their lives and their children's future, the colonists' flight from these settlements may prove to be a permanent exodus. They may have finally realized that living on land stolen from another people will never make them safe. The level of military engagement between the Palestinian resistance and the Zionist colonial forces is wide-ranging. It has included more than 2 dozen battle sites. The site of the Palestinian resistance storming Zionist regime checkpoints separating Gaza from the occupied territories was astounding, not only to the Israelis, but especially to the Palestinian and Arab peoples who came out across the region to march in support of the Palestinians in their battle against their cruel colonizers. Indeed, Jordanian security blocked Jordanians who marched to the Israeli border from advancing. No less awesome were the scenes witnessed by millions of jubilant Arabs who spent the day watching the news of Palestinian resistance from Gaza, the rows of abandoned Israeli regime tanks and armored vehicles upon which they placed their banners, has both shaken the Zionist society and struck Palestinians and Arabs as incredible. No less striking was the capture of some of the Zionist colonial troops and officers in their underwear while sleeping. Images of humiliated Egyptian prisoners of war in their underwear during the 1967 war, not to mention those of Palestinian POWs held by Israeli troops, continue to resonate in the collective memory of mankind. After the Zionist regime bombs destroyed the Palestine Tower, a high-rise with dozens of residential apartments in Gaza, resistance groups retaliated by launching large volleys of missiles at Tel Aviv. The barbaric Israeli regime bombing of Gaza, including the targeting of civilian homes without any warning, has already martyred many Palestinians, including many children. Meanwhile, the Palestinian operation has resulted in many fatalities between the Zionists. As expected, the international enemies of the Palestinian people rushed to declare support for Israeli apartheid and settler colonialism and to condemn the Palestinian resistance. This included the Palestinian people's chief enemies, namely the United States, the United Kingdom, and the European Union. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, whose alliance with the West against Russia is pushing the world to the brink of nuclear war, joined his Western sponsors in condemning the Palestinian resistance as terrorist and asserting that Israel's right to self-defense is unquestionable. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, not known for his love of the Palestinian people, found it in his heart to call for the return of abducted Zionist people from the Gaza Strip. Guterres said civilians must be respected and protected by international humanitarian law at all times, calling for the immediate release of all abducted Zionists. But there was no word from Guterres on the more than 5,000 Palestinian POWs and abductees, a term he never uses to describe the Palestinians the Zionist regime abducts and imprisons in the Zionist regime's dungeons. Nor did he express any consideration of the Palestinian right to resist occupation under international law.
Hidden Files. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Children's carefree laughter is one of the most heartwarming sounds in the world. Watching them run around, fall, and get back on their feet again gives us hope for life. Now, what would it be like if, instead of nice and strong skin, the children's body was covered with a layer as delicate as the wings of a butterfly? What if every little bump would mean a burning blister? How then would a child run and play and fill the world with joy? Today's program is on the plight of Iran's butterfly children, whose access to medicine is entangled with political sanctions placed on the country. But who are the butterfly children, and what exactly is their condition?
Epidermolysis bullosa is a genetic condition which affects the skin. It is caused by faults in the proteins that act as the glue which holds our layers of skin together. In EB, the slightest knock or bump causes the skin layers to separate, making blisters and wounds. Kids born with it are often called butterfly children because their skin is as fragile as the wings of a butterfly. Skin is our protection from the outside world. Skin that is working properly allows us to play, run, hug, sleep without a thought. It's not the same for people who live with EB. Walking becomes increasingly hard over time as the feet get more and more damaged. The simple joy of holding a crayon becomes difficult as the fingers fuse together. And eating is frightening as the lining of the throat blisters, sometimes causing kids to choke. In really bad cases, almost no part of the body remains untouched by EB. And people with it live with the constant threat of skin cancer. There is no cure for EB, and caring for children means agonizing 3-hour bandage changes every second day. It is a heartbreaking routine, usually done by mom or dad, and is so traumatizing it can have a devastating effect on the bond between parent and child. In fact, because EB care demands so much time, it can have a huge effect on all the family.
Living with this condition is painful enough when one has access to all the latest forms of treatment available, but there are parents and doctors around the world who are having to fight with forces beyond their biggest resources, like those who live in countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, and many others. What forces are we exactly talking about? Well, we're talking about U.S.-imposed sanctions that make it nearly impossible for these patients to receive the much-needed medical supplies. And this is not only the case for EB patients in Iran. You see, one of the many requirements in living with this disease is a special type of bandage. This bandage must be able to help protect the patient's very fragile skin against any pressure that can cause it to blister. At the same time, this bandage must be made of special material so as not to stick to the patient's skin. Otherwise, in order to be changed, it has to be peeled off the EB patient, which can be extremely painful and cause terrible blisters by itself. And this special bandage is made by a Swedish company, a company that refuses to sell its products to Iranian EB patients as it fears being punished due to U.S. enforced sanctions on Iran. There were some heart-rending stories that I heard while visiting the EB home, and the NGO has sent official letters to the company requesting that the required medical supplies be sold to Iranian patients, as you see here. Yet, the company's response is that it cannot be done, unfortunately, due to the U.S. economic sanctions in force. Now, the question is, what remains is the legality of these sanctions internationally, and what can be done to resolve the issues faced by these patients? So, to discuss this situation further, we will be joined shortly by United Nations Special Rapporteur, Dr. Elena Duhon.
Dr. Elena Duhon is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. She is a professor of international law. Her teaching and research concentrate on sanctions and human rights law, international law, and international environmental law. She is the author of more than 150 books and articles on international law. She has over 40 publications which focus on human rights, targeted and comprehensive sanctions, unilateral coercive measures, and freedom of opinion.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Duhan. What's your assessment of the effect of U.S. unilateral sanctions on the people of these nations?
Well, unfortunately, when it comes to the use of unilateral sanctions, people are affected. Usually, the whole population of the country is affected quite broadly, especially in the health area. So, situation in Iran is not so bad as it some other countries being under unilateral sanctions, in a view of the fact that Iran is producing more than 90% of its medicine domestically. We need to take into account, however, that even when the country is producing the medicine domestically, people which are in need of this medicine may still be affected. Take into account that countries need to import raw materials for the medicine. And unfortunately, with the use of unilateral sanctions, especially the comprehensive unilateral sanctions towards Iran, many producers of raw materials are very much reluctant to sell raw materials to Iran. There are problems with delivery and payment. There is a need to use alternative means for payments and delivery. And therefore, it's very complicated to guarantee necessary quality of raw materials.
Well, you talked about the restrictions and the difficulties. What can be done about this situation?
I received information about this situation a few months ago, and I have drafted a communication to the company and to Sweden asking for the assistance on that situation. And unfortunately, the responses which I received unofficially were demonstrating the concerns of the company to be subjected to the sanctions of the United States from one side because of getting money from Iran. Secondly, there were concerns about the ways to get payment from Iran and the ways to deliver these bandages from Sweden to Iran. Previous time, that was UNICEF, which directly engaged into negotiations with Sweden, which resulted in the possibility to deliver the year storage of bandages. Unfortunately, the storage will be over around September this year. And now UNICEF is cooperating again with Sweden and the company trying to deliver these bandages to the EB patients. Unfortunately, as I have said, that's an ad hoc solution. After coming back from Iran, I also had a meeting with the ambassador of Sweden, and we discussed this situation, and I pointed out that the ad hoc solution is not a solution for the problem. People shall not leave not knowing whether they will be able to get the bandages tomorrow or in a year or not, and what caused them suffering and naturally deteriorate their quality of life. So I asked them to get engaged with the company and to guarantee the unimpeded procurement of this medicine.
What is it going to take to resolve this once and for all?
So the very first step, what the United Nations did, it established this mandate. So basically that was a response to the use of unilateral sanctions and plus to the humanitarian impact unilateral sanctions do. So as I have mentioned, I tried to raise awareness to show specific evidences of humanitarian impact, because what I often face in my work is when I start to talk to the embassies of the countries in which the companies producing the unique equipment are registered, they say, oh, we didn't know, we didn't realize that people are suffering that much and that people are dying. So that was the very first step of the activity of the United Nations. Again, when we are speaking about the short-term solutions, the UN agencies in the countries, and in particular, I speak about a number of specialized agencies in Iran, are very actively engaging now to guarantee the delivery of the basic medical goods necessary for the survival of the people. For example, UNICEF in Iran is very actively engaging to procure the bandages to the EB patients and to procure some other necessary medical equipment for people suffering from severe diseases. However, we need to realize that that's ad hoc solutions, trying to handle the situation for a very short period for a very limited group of people. Around a month ago, me together with some other special rapporteurs have issued a press release calling for a total lifting of unilateral sanctions imposed over critical infrastructure, medical goods, without any need to get extra licenses. Because today, unfortunately, something what has been announced to be called humanitarian exceptions is not functioning at all. It's necessary to get a license. It's necessary to find a way how to transfer money, how to guarantee the delivery. When we speak about EB patients in Iran, the recent attempt of UNICEF to deliver a little bit more than a year storage of bandages for EB patient took a year and a half. And today they are trying to engage into delivery of the second delivery. At the same time, I believe that the United Nations shall guarantee that this means all sorts of critical goods are exempted from the use of unilateral sanctions, first of all. In the long-term perspective, I try now to engage with many UN institutions as well as with states and humanitarian actors and scholars to bring attention to the issue of legality. If states will stop to use illegal means, that will mean that we won't need to have the notion what is called humanitarian exception, because sanctions will not be imposed and the states will be able to guarantee the delivery of life-saving medicine.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Dr. Elena Duhani. Now, Iran's EB patients have only a few months' worth of special bandages left. They don't know if and when they can receive the next shipment. Many are too young to even understand what sanctions are, and others can't see why their treatment should have anything to do with politics and sanctions against Iran, which are deemed illegal by international standards. Plus, it's not only EB patients who are suffering as a result of these sanctions. All patients whose required medicine and treatment are not entirely made in Iran are affected by these multifaceted sanctions. Now, this leaves Iran's doctors no choice but to either find a way to get around the sanctions or to tell their patients, sorry, I don't think that you will make it. Isn't it ironic, though, that these sanctions are placed on Iran by the U.S., which claims to be the flag bearer of human rights, when in reality Washington has one of the worst records of waging wars against various nations, using their government's violation of these same rights as an excuse. And now the war is on. The U.S. government against special needs patients in sanctioned countries. Will the special needs patients win this battle and be able to heal their wounds, or will the U.S. manage to cause them to die in agony? Either way, these innocent patients will be the only victors in this cowardly war. Until next week, when we come to you to shed light on a whole other set of Hidden Files. Goodbye for me, Marzieh Hashemi, and from the whole crew right here in the studio. We'll be right back.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey has found that the number of American households reporting tumbling incomes is growing. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, the number of U.S. adults with declining incomes has soared in recent weeks in a sign of a weakening labor market. And that was according to a Bloomberg report. Bloomberg added, the share of households facing a drop in their incomes rose from 10.7% in August to 11.8% last month. Citing a survey of the U.S. labor market by data intelligence company Morning Consult, the increase was mainly driven by high- and middle-income families and the West region of the United States. About 20% of adults polled who earn $100,000 or more annually reported that they expected their incomes to drop in the next 4 weeks. RT added, the share of employees who reported working over 35 hours fell to 46.7%, representing a 12% drop from September 2022. The decline marked the lowest level since the spring of 2021, signaling a slowdown in U.S. business activity, the survey revealed. The most cited reason by respondents was soft business conditions. This comes as U.S. inflation-adjusted household income fell by the most in 12 years in 2022, highlighting the toll of a higher cost of living and the expiration of pandemic-era programs. The income and poverty data released by the U.S. Census last month showed how deeply the U.S. economic conditions were affected by the COVID-19 crisis and the government's response to it. The measure of child poverty more than doubled following the expiry of pandemic-era child tax credits last year amid the worst inflation in 40 years, which has undermined household spending power. Thank you. In another report, RT wrote, as Uncle Sam continues to pump billions of dollars into Kiev's flagging fight against Russia and provide tempting handouts to illegal migrants, why is the average American worker forced to live paycheck to paycheck? Here's a question that most people have considered at least once in their lives and probably a lot recently. How much annual income would you need to feel financially secure? For the average American, the magic number comes out to be $233,000 a year, according to a survey by Bankrate. To bring the 99% back down to earth, the U.S. Census Bureau released some sobering data that dashed those elusive six-digit dreams. Inflation-adjusted median household income fell to $74,580 in 2022, a 2,300 decline from 2021 average of $76,330. This marks the third straight annual decrease since the COVID-19 pandemic began in 2020, taking a wrecking ball to the heart of the economy. The bad news doesn't end there for U.S. consumers, who are now struggling with the consequences of a foreign conflict in a distant land and a wide open border. Those factors have prompted the cost of living to surge higher than it has in over four decades amid runaway inflation. In June 2022, the year-over-year inflation rate, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, hit a jaw-dropping 9.1%, the highest it has been since the administration of former President Ronald Reagan. A significant reason for the increase in inflation happened on March 3, 2022, when President Joe Biden signed an executive order to ban the import of Russian oil, liquefied natural gas, and coal to the U.S. This decision has had disastrous results for the local economy. Since Biden's inauguration, the cost of gasoline alone had jumped at one point by 100%. As of September 27th, the average price of regular gas was $3.832 per gallon, according to the AAA, while gas prices were an average of $2.3 per gallon when Biden entered office, forcing just about everything else to skyrocket, including the number of poor people in the U.S. The poverty rate in the U.S. exploded last year, the first increase in 13 years, and that was according to the Census Bureau. In 2022, the rate was 12.4%, up 4.6 percentage points from 2021, according to the Supplemental Poverty Measure, SPM, a method for tallying government welfare programs and tax credits designed to assist low-income families. Meanwhile, the expectations index, determined by consumers' short-term outlook for income, business, and labor market conditions, sunk to 73.7 in September. That follows a drop to 83.3 in August. The worrisome part is that an expectation index below 80 generally indicates an impending recession. An economic tragedy is already quietly happening for millions of American consumers who are now living paycheck to paycheck precariously and who have been forced to use the payment method of last resort to make ends meet, the almighty credit card with its exorbitant interest fees. On this score, the U.S. economy has broken yet another record, although not in a way that could be considered something to cheer about. The Street reported U.S. credit card debt rose by $45 billion to $1.3 trillion in the second quarter from the first quarter. a 4.6% quarterly increase. The Street added, it's the first time in U.S. history that household credit card balances topped $1 trillion mark as the number of credit card accounts expanded by 5.48 million to 578.35 million in the quarter. When consumer debt suddenly equals the amount the U.S. spends on its military-industrial complex, you know there is a problem. Clearly, the U.S. has some serious domestic issues that need to be resolved, but instead, it would rather fund a totally senseless proxy war against a nuclear power halfway around the world. Washington has given Ukraine close to $100 billion in aid, with more in the pipeline, since Moscow launched its operation in February 2022. The cash, however, has not only been used to fund Ukraine's military. Billions of dollars have subsidized participants of the Ukrainian economy, like farmers and small business owners, market players whose counterparts in the U.S. desperately need help too. A recent study conducted by the Council on Foreign Relations shows that more than $30 billion, around 40% of total U.S. aid to Ukraine as of July 31st, has been financial or humanitarian assistance that is not directly connected to military support. Military funding comes out to around $50 billion.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel is pushing ahead with its deadly airstrikes on